The Joe Mason Show is on. Is on in five. In five. Four. Four. Three. Three. Two. Two. One. One.
Welcome to the Phil Nixon Show. I'm happy to have you here. We are going to spend the entire program today talking about David Stern, my favorite commissioner of all time in any sport. I think he's just marvelous. Ah, you know, don't you? You've been listening to this show for the last 5 years. You know, don't you, that I despise David Stern. But we're going to talk about him anyway because he's done a couple of good things, maybe. And since he's on his way out or should be out, I thought we'd talk about him today. Later on, Zeb Benbrook and I will be talking about him a little bit. He has some good things to say about him, I'm sure. But up first, from PoundingTheRock.com, Aaron Stampler's here. All right, Aaron, what do you think about David Stern?
Well, I mean, from a Spurs fan point of view, I think it's kind of hard, if you look at the big picture, to not appreciate David Stern. I think he's done a lot of good things for small market teams, and especially the Spurs. I mean, with the salary cap that enabled every team to kind of compete for stars on an equal footing, and enabled the Spurs to keep their guys once they were established stars. You know, keep the Manu Ginobili's and Tony Parker's out there, because it's not like, you know, the Knicks or some big market team could have paid them twice as much as what the Spurs were going to pay them. So, you know, in that respect, you know, the salary cap really helped the Spurs out a lot. And also just David Stern's international vision. I mean, I think that's provided huge benefits for the Spurs because, you know, they were a team that, because of the success they had in the late 90s, early 2000s with Tim Duncan, you know, winning championships or always being contention. They were always drafting very late. And they had to look elsewhere, you know, for talent. And they got lucky a couple times with Manu Ginobili with the second-to-last pick of the draft in 1999, and then with Tony Parker, the 28th pick of the first round in 2001.
Okay, from a Spurs standpoint, I don't even know why any Spurs fan would even like David Stern. He's been abusive to the Spurs, to be honest with you. But let's get back to the salary cap. Now, let me play devil's advocate, since it's my show and since I'm going to have an opinion on this. What about the person who says to you, well, listen, Aaron, salary cap, that's ridiculous. If a small market team can't afford to keep their players, they shouldn't have their team. What do you say to that guy?
I just say that's not realistic. I mean, in every sport, you're going to have big market teams and small market teams. It's a reality of whether you're talking about American sports, whether you're talking about European soccer, or really soccer anywhere in the world. But, you know, it's just the nature of the beast. I mean, it's like it's the nature of capitalism in general. You have bigger companies and you have smaller companies. The idea of having a salary cap where, you know, a superstar isn't going to make more in one area than another area, I think has been huge for small market teams. And, you know, it's not the fault of the cities that they're located where they're located. I mean, at the end of the day, they are still businesses and they have to make, if not a profit, they have to at least be able to break even or close to that. They can't just, you know, operate losing hundreds of millions of dollars. So, you know, you can't fault, you know, owners of small market teams, like, for not spending as much when they don't make that kind of revenue.
So then, honestly, so if I own the Lakers, then I have to suffer. I can't go out and get the best players possible because I have to give the New Orleans Pelicans the same chances I have? How is that fair? How is that fair in a business standpoint? Because it's not. Because no business works that way. If I can pay you more money to come and write for me, you're going to do it, right?
Well, I mean, it's not like the Lakers have ever hurt for talent, but they have built-in advantages in other ways. Number one, free agents want to play for them. You know, I mean, all things considered, they want to play for them because of a reputation of the Lakers, because of their location, you know, because of the built-in advantages for, you know, just being in Los Angeles. And, you know, people over there, they get more exposure, so they'll make more in endorsement money. You know, they'll make more, like, maybe, you know, they'll get to be in movies like Shaquille O'Neal was. And if it's the kind of thing where if everything else is equal and you're not, you know, you're not really attached to your old team, then yeah, a lot of free agents will go to Lakers if they can. But the situation is, you know, for the small market teams is, you know, well, if their players already like, you know, the cities they're playing in, if they don't necessarily have that desire to be a big public figure, you know, to be on SportsCenter every night, if they're just about playing basketball and nothing else, then it makes sense for them to stay where they are because the money won't be that much different as far as their playing contracts.
That's fair enough. But what do you say to a team like, well, Oklahoma City, for example, who can't afford to keep their players? They're a small market team. The salary cap is instituted. How does that help them?
Well, I think that's kind of the difference between Oklahoma City and a team like San Antonio is that Oklahoma City's owner, for whatever reason, refuses to go even like a dollar above the salary cap, where the Spurs in the past have gone above the cap here and there, you know, into the luxury tax a little bit here and there. I mean, not outrageously like, you know, the Brooklyn Nets will or the New York Knicks will, but they've gone over it on occasion, you know, to keep their guys. But where Clay Bennett from Oklahoma City, who is a much wealthier owner, by the way, than the Spurs owner, Peter Holt, he just refuses philosophically to go over the cap, and that's what cost them James Harden, and he just didn't want to pay James Harden the max. But also, I think that's kind of the difference between James Harden and the Spurs guys. Tony Parker has had opportunities in the past to be a max player, and he's taken less. Manu Ginobili took less on a couple of occasions than he could have made elsewhere, where James Harden stressed to the management of Oklahoma City that he wants to be a max player, and that's what got him traded. I think if he gave him a more reasonable offer, he could have been there and they could have had some kind of dynasty in the making.
Yep, but they didn't do that. And the problem is that, and yet they cry poor, but they have the money. Obviously, you have to have money to own an NBA team. And let's face it, professional sports teams, you don't make money until you sell the team. That's when you really make your money. That's when you find out. Ask George Bush. But I guess I'm not a favor of it because teams still bend that rule. I mean, look at Brooklyn. They bent that rule. New York has bent that rule. And look what they wound up with. Nothing. But still in all, I'm not a big fan of it. I think that teams should go out there and get their thing. And if you can't afford to sign big stars, then you need to spend a little more time drafting better, like the Spurs have done, like the Oklahoma City Thunder have done. And then the other flips, and the other thing you need to do is make them want to stay. And unfortunately for some teams, those guys don't want to stay. So what do you do?
I think the difference between basketball and the other sports is that the individual matters a lot more in basketball than like in baseball. I mean, one guy is not going to win you a championship or even get you in contention in baseball. As good as any one player is, you can be Barry Bonds. If the 24 guys around you are terrible, you're not going to win any games in baseball. And same thing in football. You could have Peyton Manning. If the team around him is, you know, the Cleveland Browns, he's not going to do anything. And, you know, in hockey, the same thing. But in basketball, there's only five guys on the court, and one guy makes so much of a difference. I mean, look at those Cleveland teams with LeBron James, you know, where he pretty much carried a team single-handedly to the NBA Finals once and to contention a number of other years. And I think the individual matters so much more in basketball that if you could keep that one guy, if you could, you know, prevent him from getting out into free agency, then you have a strong chance for contention. And it's not as simple as being a great organization and drafting well every couple of years because, as you know, those once-in-a-generation players, they're called once-in-a-generation players for a reason. They don't come very often. Every draft doesn't have a Tim Duncan or a LeBron James or a Shaquille O'Neal. Some drafts, the number one overall pick is a Joe Smith or a Michael Olowo Kandi. And those teams that, you know, are unfortunate enough to have the first pick that year, they're just stuck in a bad situation for years and years. And, you know, every draft doesn't have that transformational superstar. I mean, I think you could argue both in 1999 and 2001 that Tony Parker and Manu Ginobili were either the best or second best player in their own drafts. And, you know, and they're not the kind of guys where you're going to win championships or contend single-handedly with those guys on the team. So, and they're still Hall of Famers. So that's the difference between having a Hall of Fame, you know, borderline Hall of Fame player, a perennial all-star, and a once-in-a-generation player like a LeBron James or a Michael Jordan or a Tim Duncan. And those guys just don't come around very often.
Nope, they don't. But Oklahoma City, we'll talk about them later. I don't want to be talking behind the guy. But honestly speaking, they've drafted very well, and they won't be able to keep any of those guys.
I don't know about that. I don't necessarily think either Russell Westbrook or Kevin Durant is unhappy. I think whether they stay or not is going to depend on how much success they have as a team over the next 2-3 years. If they could win a championship, you know, or two, these next 2-3 years, I think those guys will be content to stay. If they never get it done, then they'll be like, well, our owner didn't spend enough, and you know, he didn't put enough pieces around us, so let's go elsewhere, like LeBron did.
Yep, LeBron left and took less money. And that's what all these guys will do, is leave and take less money, and they'll go where they like to go. So how does the salary cap help them? How does the salary cap stop that?
It doesn't, but that's where the onus is on the organization to surround those stars with good quality pieces around them, with role players, you know, and good coaches and all the ingredients you need to have a championship. But, I mean, even if you put yourself in a situation where you're going to contend for 5-6 years, that's still a big window, and it's a much bigger window than, you'll see in other sports like football or baseball. At least you're giving yourself, at least these small market teams give themselves a chance to, you know, a window for 5-6 years, and that's all you can ask for as a fan.
That's fair enough. Now, what's another thing that you liked about David Stern?
Well, like I said, I think just the 92 Olympics really changed basketball in the NBA as we know it. I think the dream team out there, especially with the triumvirate of Larry Bird and Magic Johnson and Michael Jordan, I think that influenced the whole world's view of the NBA, and they gave a lot of those foreign kids out there, you know, a dream to pursue in the NBA, even though that team was demolishing, you know, every opponent in those Olympics. The exposure still had a huge influence on the Dirk Nowitzkis, on the Pau Gasols and Marc Gasols, on the Ginobili's and the Parkers and all these countless other international players. Now, like, the league is 1/4 international players, pretty much. And every team seems to have a couple guys, you know, who are impact players from outside of the United States. And I think that's been huge to making this the second biggest global game behind soccer. And I think David Stern had a lot to do. I mean, he didn't have anything to do really with the idea of the Dream Team. But once, you know, he was on board with the idea of putting professionals in the Olympics, he was the guy who had the vision and the clout to get Magic Johnson on a team when, you know, he had just announced that he was HIV positive, and there was, you know, there wasn't nearly the knowledge about that disease that we have now. And, you know, people wondered, is it safe? Is he going to expose other athletes? But David Stern fought to put Magic on the team. And without Magic, there would have been no Larry Bird. Larry Bird didn't want to play in those games. He had a horrible back injury by then. He was practically near retirement. But Magic convinced Larry Bird to come. And with Magic and Larry, they convinced Michael Jordan to come, because Michael Jordan initially wanted no part of the Dream Team, because he had already won a gold medal as a collegian in 1994, you know, with Bobby Knight. So once you got those three guys on board, it really increased that whole team's exposure, and that they made the Dream Team what it was.
And what do you say to the guy who says to you, Aaron, that team would have beaten any of those teams without those three players you mentioned? And those guys still would have shown up.
No question. They would have won the gold regardless. But I think it's just a different level of exposure having those icons. I mean, when you think of basketball in the 80s and mid-90s, you think of Magic, Larry Bird, and Michael Jordan. Those three guys are pretty much credited with saving the NBA. I mean, they're the guys who took the NBA out of irrelevance and made it the second biggest sport in America after football.
Basketball is?
Yeah.
In America? I think so.
Absolutely.
For spectators to watch on TV?
Yes, absolutely.
Because baseball would be number two as a live event to attend. I'm pretty sure of that. But anyhow, you know what? And that's fair enough. Now, one of the things, though, that I was always puzzled about, and which puzzled me about your article, is that, you know, Stern has picked on the Spurs. Look what he did with the $250,000 fine. A lot of people, even people who don't like the Spurs, and I know that you're going to find this hard to believe, but there are a lot of people who don't like the Spurs. were just aghast at it. They thought it was unfair to fine him $250,000, yet not do a single thing about tanking and losing on purpose, which is far worse, or damages the integrity of the NBA far worse than Greg Popovich resting aging veterans. What did you think about that fine?
Well, I mean, no doubt that fine was petty. And, I mean, I think there's plenty of, information available out there that will tell you that, David Stern has never been a big fan of the Spurs and never been a big fan of Greg Popovich in particular. But I don't think he's necessarily unique in the regard of, you know, having a personal bias against some team. I think every commissioner has teams that, you know, they like and they don't like, both for personal reasons and for professional reasons in terms of TV ratings. I mean, it's not David Stern's fault that the Spurs don't get any ratings, and I think he has tried in the past to market them. He has tried. He tried really hard to sell Manu Ginobili to the world in 2005. He tried really hard to sell Tony Parker to the world in 2007. And America just was not buying it. America was just not interested. They just would not buy those guys. I don't know if it was because they were foreign or what, but or maybe because their answers and interviews weren't controversial enough. They didn't have the, you know, oh, this teammate hates that teammate, you know, drama that the Lakers did with Shaquille O'Neal and Kobe Bryant. They didn't necessarily have, like, these big flashy dunks. You know, Ginobili pretty much stopped dunking after 2005. And, you know, so he tried to market the Spurs, and it just wasn't happening. And I think a lot of the efforts to market them have been rebuffed by Tim Duncan and Greg Popovich, who just are very resistant to do any kind of interviews on a public stage. They don't want cameras to cover the team in, like, some kind of, like, inside the Spurs kind of fashion. You know, they're not going to give you any access to anything. They want to keep everything close to the vest and hush-hush. There's never any controversy with the team, no drama with the team. You never know anything that's going on behind the scenes. They're very, you know, good about hiding information. So they just don't want that exposure, and it's kind of like a two-way street. I mean, you could argue the Spurs don't get attention, but at the same time, they don't want that attention. So, and I think they've resisted every attempt from Stern to market them, and that's kind of brought up David Stern's bitterness. It's like David Stern looks at the Spurs and goes, don't you understand what makes, you know, this league popular? You know, that, you know, the fans who are paying, who want to be interested by your team. And Popovich and Tim Duncan have already been like, no, we just want to play good basketball. That's all we care about. That's all the fans should care about. And I think in some respects, they're naive to how the business of basketball works.
And that's fair enough. Maybe they are. But you know what? That's their prerogative as a team and as an organization. They feel they market themselves well, and they do, because they sell out every night, and they've been able to financially stay afloat, and they are a small market team. And they've drafted well, and they've been lucky in their drafts, too. Now, what do you say? We've only got about 6 minutes here, and that'll probably kill it, this one here. What do you think about the tanking issue and why he hasn't ever addressed that?
I don't think you could blame teams for tanking. I mean, like I said before, you have these once-in-a-generation superstars, and they're the difference between your team being a contender for the next 6-7 years or just being completely irrelevant. I mean, as a Spurs fan, I'd be the last person to ever, you know, decry tanking, because I saw them do it with my own eyes in 1997 or 1996 when they pretty much shut down David Robinson and a bunch of other veterans on that team and went full out to tank in the hopes of that lottery chance of landing Tim Duncan, and they happened to win the lottery that year. Without Tim Duncan, if he was never a Spur, the San Antonio Spurs probably don't even exist right now. They're probably in some other market. I mean, once David Robinson retired, the fans would have stopped showing up. I mean, people say the Spurs have this big, passionate fan base, but that big, passionate fan base, you know, only arrives to watch the star players. And if the team is not in contention, if they're just a dog team, they're going to stop coming. They're, you know, the San Antonians don't have that much money to begin with, and the precious few dollars they have, they're not going to spend it on a horrible team, on a horrible product. So, that team was in danger of losing that team before David Robinson, and they would have surely lost them once Robinson retired or moved on. So I'm the last person to cry tanking. I understand why teams do it, because, I mean, you have to do whatever you have to do to get a LeBron James, to get a Tim Duncan, because those guys bring millions upon millions of dollars, billions of dollars to a city.
That's fair enough, but he's the commissioner of the NBA, and he has a duty to ensure that every NBA team goes out there and puts the best product available. And tanking is not the best product available. When I know someone's going to lose on purpose, I start to question the credibility. I don't care about their drafts. I care about my Wednesday night and what teams I want to watch and what games I want to watch. And why would I want to watch if there's only one basketball game on? For example, the San Antonio Spurs take on the Utah Jazz when we know the Jazz are tanking. Now, why would I want to watch that? And I know a lot of fans that feel that way too. David Stern has never addressed that, not even once. He's not even tried to address it. And I think that that's a big mistake. I think that's going to be part of his lasting legacy, is that on real issues like tanking, which is in my sport of tennis, if you get caught tanking, you get suspended, fined, the whole nine yards. You know, in baseball, it's the same thing. If you're losing on purpose, you're going to get fined. In football, if they catch you, you're going to get fined. In basketball, they almost encourage it. And I think it's just it sends a bad message out there. To lose on purpose is not competitive action. It's just a joke. It reduces the credibility of the league when the commissioner refuses to stand up and say something about it, anything about it. He's not done anything, period. I understand why people tank, because they get away with it because it's part of the game, they say. But the game is about winning and losing and putting out your best team out there and putting your best foot forward. And a team that's tanking does not do that. And I don't care how many times you benefited from it, it's hurt the game. It's probably cost fans in the end of the day.
Well, I mean, tanking is just another version of like what the Spurs did when they got that $250,000 fine, you know, sending their stars home for the, you know, in that fourth game in five nights against Miami. It's a big picture move instead of a small picture move. And I think Nuance fans understand that sometimes, you know, the team is going to be bad, but they're suffering for a reason to do what they can for brighter days ahead. So I think the people who complain about tanking are people who are looking at it in the short term instead of the long term. But as far as what they can do about it, I'm not sure what you can do about it, because, I mean, it's really hard to prove in any case that a team is trying to lose games on purpose. I mean, the players on the floor are trying hard. It's just the coaches put players on the floor who are not the best players, as you say, they put their worst players on the floor in some cases, you know, or young kids who aren't experienced, you know, they'll like be winning a game through three quarters, but they don't have the experience to pull out those fourth quarters against veteran teams who are trying. And it's hard to prove that, you know, a team is trying to lose on purpose when the players on the floor are trying their best. It's just they're not very good players. And, you know, it's just one of those things where, you know, it's hard to prove one way or the other. And, you know, it's also hard to prove when if a guy says he has a hamstring injury or he has a sprained ankle or a sprained wrist, it's hard as a league to say, oh, no, that guy's healthy.
Well, it's not hard at all. They do like they do in tennis and have league doctors and association doctors there to check you out. You can't just say, oh, my back hurts, and pull out of a tennis match. You'll get fined for that. You have to prove that you've been hurt. And they can do that in basketball too. They just don't want to. Because, well, like you say, and Nuance fans, Aaron, don't understand it. Okay, no one understands losing on purpose. No one does. That's just totally against sport. Completely against sport. And my point is David Stern, while maybe he can't do anything personally about it, he's never spoken out loud about it either. Anyway, great stuff today. Thanks for being on the show, man.
Thanks for having me.
All right, that was Aaron Stampler. You can find him over at poundingtherock.com. Coming up next, Seth Benbrook and I will continue our Ode to David Stern, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Phil Nason Show.
This is The Phil Nason Show.
And it's the reason Al Gore invented the internet.
And we'll be right back after these brief announcements.
Do you know your fantasy sports? Would you like to make money at it? DraftStreet.com and The Phil Nason Show would like to help you get started making money playing fantasy sports today. and we'll even give you the chance to get started making money today for free on me. That's right. All you have to do is head on over to PhilNasons.com or visit the show notes for this show. Click the Draft Street image at the top of the page and start making money playing fantasy sports at DraftStreet.com today. Are you looking to escape into lands full of fantasy, drama, and adventure? If you are, why not try author K. Metter's books? Their Journey Begins, Journey to Freedom, The Night of the Dixie Wilds, On Top of the Rainbow, and Transcendence will get you there. K. Metter's books are available as an ebook or in paperback, and you can find her at authorkmetter.com. That's author K M E A D O R.com. Hi, this is Phil Nasons from This Week in Tennis and The Phil Nasons Show. Max Sports Channels offers the best in sports talk radio, as well as great music 24 hours a day. It's my daily destination, and I hope it's yours. The sports talk begins each and every day at 3 p.m. and ends around 9 p.m. Special programming on the weekends. And in between all that, the hottest music on the internet. That's Max Sports Channels. Make it your daily destination.
If you are a fan of historical fiction, then the Britain and the Dane novels are right up your alley. Surrounding 9th century Anglo-Saxon history are five amazing novels that will leave you breathless. To purchase any or all of the Britain and the Dane historical fiction novels, please visit MarianneBernal.com. That's www.MarianneBernal.com.
Brewtown Sports is your source for Brewers news and notes. Join Mr. Brewtown as he keeps you up to date on all the happenings of your Milwaukee Brewers and Major League Baseball. Follow the show on Facebook and Twitter, Brewtown Sports. Listen 24/7 at BrewtownSports.podomatic.com.
Riveting talk radio.
Everybody get up.
People cannot get away from the internet.
Well,
no.
I think, and it probably comes from porn as well.
Yeah.
I mean, that's got to be a big, strong thing.
Oh, that's gross. That's disgusting.
And it freaks me out.
My cheeks are sealed.
We love talk radio.
Bend over, baby.
Do you see what I'm saying?
WeirdTalkSuperstation.com.
Better than sex.
I don't know how good sex is.
We're going to do a lot of drinking.
Talk radio. Bend over, baby.
That was great.
If you like baseball, you should be checking out baseballpodcasts.net. It's one of the best places you can go on the internet to listen to independent baseball talk shows 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on our radio player that can be heard around the world. So won't you tune in and give us a listen at baseballpodcasts.net. You can also listen to the great Phil Nasons show here. See you there at baseballpodcasts.net.
Stitcher Smart Radio is an award-winning, free mobile application that lets you listen to your favorite shows and discover the best of news, entertainment, and sports on demand. Now you don't even need a Wi-Fi or a cell connection to listen to shows like The Phil Nasons Show. Never miss another show. It's real simple. Just go to Stitcher.com and download the free app today. And never miss another Phil Nasons Show.
Hi, this is Gary Mack of Mets Musings, and I hope you'll join me each and every week as I recap all of the comings and goings-on in New York Mets baseball. I'll have guests on from all across Mets Nation giving their insights and analysis on the New York Mets. And you can follow me on Twitter at MetsMusings1, as well as on Facebook. Group name is Mets Musings. So tune in weekly to the Mets Musings, available at MetsMusings.com, Stitcher.com, iTunes.com, iHeartRadio, and of course, BaseballTalkRadio.com, the home of great baseball talk shows.
And now, back to the Phil Nason Show.
By the way, ladies and gentlemen, as always, this stuff in lieu of actual entertainment.
Welcome back to the Phil Nason Show, and we continue our ode to David Stern with welcome to LoudCity.com's lead writer, Zeb Benbrook is in the house. Zeb, how you doing, man? Welcome to the show.
Doing great. Thanks for having me on again.
It's my pleasure. I've had a hard time saying your name all night. I don't know why that is, but it's kind of silly. But anyway, David Stern, what are your thoughts now? 30 years as the commissioner, and we talked a little about him earlier, about salary caps and stuff. What do you think his lasting legacy will be?
Well, you know, I think his lasting legacy is just going to be expanding the league. I mean, there hasn't been a lot of whole lot of negative controversy lately, and he's done a great job of marketing the league to an international audience, to a national audience, bringing it from something that had to compete with another league domestically, the ABA. You know, after that whole debacle and dealing with the rinky-dink league and dealing with drug scandals in the 80s and stuff like that, he's brought it into a national and international product, and I think that's what we're really going to remember him for. And I think it's evidenced by the Sports Nation poll that they had that I put up on my site a little bit ago that talked about – that had all the different states, and it said, how would you rate David Stern's tenure as commissioner? Now, I don't think it's possible for any commissioner in a major American sport to get A's across the board, but 48 states plus the rest of the world gave David Stern a B. Washington gave David Stern an F, and Oklahoma gave David Stern an A. So that's basically telling you what his legacy is to the nation. I mean, the nation thinks that he's great, and there's only one isolated incident that everybody's, you know, going to remember, and that's going to go away with some time. You know, we're talking about the Sonics move, and I've talked about the Sonics move 100 times, so I'm not going to get into that now. But he's a great marketer for the league, and I think that there's three things that he's done. I mean, there's three, like, issues that he's faced that he's really combated effectively and gotten rid of. For example, there was the drug issues in the 80s. He completely banned them. He got rid of them. He had a no-tolerance policy. The issue almost basically went away, unless you've got a knucklehead coming in later in the 90s or thousands, you know. But for the most part, that issue went away. Then he had the fighting issue. He suspended players for getting off the bench, you know, when there were fights in the 90s, and that helped to stop fights in the NBA because there aren't nearly as many fights as there were back in the 80s, and I know that for the truth. And the other issue he faced was kind of like the rise of hip-hop and gangster culture, especially with the 2004 Malice in the Palace and, you know, with how players were dressing and conducting themselves. Put in a dress code, not necessarily something that I agree with, but it's definitely something that gave a whole lot of good publicity to the NBA. And these players, they don't dress like, you know, gangsters anymore. I mean, I don't want to put any labels on anybody or anything like that, but they dress in like suits. They've got, you know, their own style that they're trying to express. And, you know, you look at players like Russell Westbrook who have gotten around that and kind of made the NBA into like its own product. You know, it's not copying somebody else. It's just trying to be itself. And I think that the way he handled drugs, fights, and the rise of hip-hop culture really helped to expand the NBA into the 21st century. So I think that he is going to go down as a great commissioner, but we won't really know how good he was until we get another commissioner in the seat, because he's been there for the entire modern era. So you can't really judge him against anybody else because nobody's had the same situation as he has. But I think that he was great for the NBA. And despite, you know, a couple things that we're probably going to discuss today that he really did that were terrible and I did not like, I think that overall you couldn't ask for a better commissioner.
Yeah, okay. I see him as probably one of the worst commissioners in all of sports ever. Because he just interfered.
Really?
With, oh, absolutely. He's interfered with things he's had no business doing. He's destroyed teams. He's put teams in places that shouldn't have had that team. He's always been about David Stern. Sure, the NBA benefited. Did it? Absolutely. The international outlook? Absolutely. But it would have been, that would have happened anyway. You know, but honestly, the dress code? I'll tell you what. I would rather see Dwayne Wade wearing stuff that Allen Iverson wore than some of that Pee Wee Herman crap he wears now.
Well, I mean, I totally agree. But I'm just saying for the NBA's public image, I think it's a lot better, especially when you're talking about,
yeah, that's fair enough,
you know, regular people.
Yeah, that's fair enough. There's no doubt about that. For regular people watching, sure. But these kids are just being who they are and where they're from. These kids didn't grow up in the suburbs, most of them. So, I mean, they're just being true to themselves. But they wouldn't be able to wear that gear if they were working on Wall Street. So why should they wear it in David Stern's NBA?
Nah, I mean, you know that. I mean, I just think it's a marketing thing. I mean, he's not really concerned about what he thinks about people. It's mostly just what the average American fan is going to think of a player. And, you know, a lot of people just see that as another, you know, if you're like a person sitting in your living room and you're watching that and you're living in suburban Milwaukee, you're not going to have a lot of exposure to that. So you're going to see it as something, you know, strange and different. But then you put these guys in suits and all of a sudden you kind of eliminate a little bit of that barrier. And I'm not saying that it's good. I'm not saying that it's right. I'm not saying that I like it. I'm just saying that it was the best business decision for the NBA. And in terms of making best business decisions for the NBA, I think you could have no better man than David Stern. That's all I'm saying.
And that's fair enough. That's why we all have opinions. You know, I've had the interesting opportunity of being able to watch his entire tenure, and I've seen the league change at least three times. You know what else I've seen? Four lockouts. Four of them. And there might be another one coming up. You never know. But whereas in baseball, they've been on the field for many, many years. They lost big time the last time that happened. And Bud Selig said, we're not going to let that happen again. But David Stern, not really, you know. So I always wondered about David Stern and the lockouts. And I'm not blaming him entirely for it. But he could have done more to prevent some of them, I think. What did you think about the lockouts?
Well, as a fan, I think that, you know, as a person, I think that the NBA and their owners were greedy and terrible in for making the lockouts. I mean, you know, the players probably deserve to make more money than they're making in terms of just what they bring to the team, because they are the entire product, whereas the, you know, owners are just a marketing team and they're getting over half the pay. I don't know much about how business works, but I don't think that that's right. But I do think that the lockouts weren't actually that bad for the NBA. I think that the first lockout was worse than the second, because it was longer, you lost the All-Star game, you lost a lot of publicity. But what the NBA did gain in that lockout was max salaries, and that was very important, because if they didn't install that then, think about the amount of money that Kevin Durant could be making on the Thunder while they still have a salary cap. We would be the Kevin Durant and Travis Diener team, or I don't know, whoever random player you could come out of minimum contracts, because we wouldn't be able to make anything. So he did a lot for helping out the league's financial solvency in that, because salaries would have gotten out of control. Kevin Garnett signed a huge salary that we'll never see the likes of again before that lockout, and he eliminated it. And I think in long term, that helped him out. Second, the second lockout, I think it helped with exposing the game globally, because you had a whole ton of stars, especially hometown stars like French guys, guys from Russia, you know, just going back to their home teams and increasing the talent of the EuroLeague. I mean, a couple of players like Nenad Krstić, I think, went over during the lockout, never came back. And he could probably still be playing in the NBA right now. So that actually helped increase the popularity of basketball abroad, because it gave them exposure. And then you had the whole Basketball Never Stops campaign with Nike. You had guys barnstorming. You had guys playing in, like, you know, local gymnasiums and things like that. And I think that that was really helpful for getting, like, average fans to see players, because a lot of these games were free. A lot of these games were for charity, stuff like that. And it kind of showed, like, that the players do care, because Kevin Durant was raising tons of money for charity during the lockout, and that was great. And he was playing during Rucker Park, giving us all these great highlight reels. I mean, honestly, I'm kind of glad that lockout happened, because we had a 66 game shortened season. We didn't have to watch any of the crap in November, and we got this great barnstorming tour. We had this great thing going on. And I think that both lockouts, you know, because you instilled the maximum salary, and because you had that whole international popularity during the second lockout, I honestly think that in the long term, his strategy helped get the league better publicity heading forward, like I've been saying. But, you know, because, I mean, who really is sitting here right now and thinking 2 years ago, that lockout really turned me off to the NBA, I never want to watch again? There's very few people who think that right now. So I think that what he did during the lockouts was actually beneficial.
Actually, that lockout, I stopped watching basketball. We didn't even talk about them.
Wow.
Well, the only reason, I'll tell you how I feel about lockouts. All right. The NHL, I used to host an NHL show that was extremely popular. And I had a national sponsor, and it was a nice show. And when they went on a lockout last year, I lost that. And I have not watched a game since. And I refuse to. Basketball was the same way. The only reason that I watched it is somebody told me about Linsanity, and they wanted to come on my show and talk about it. That's the only reason I even turned it back on. I was going to stop watching it for the entire season. I get so tired, and I know a lot of other people who get so tired of these young people making millions of dollars and crying about $100,000. And I get so tired of these owners who are multimillionaires who cry because they don't want to pay what this kid is worth and what the league mandates they should pay. And to me, the only ones that got hurt are the fans. There were four lockouts in David Stern's tenure. That's three too many. The 88-89 one was the worst one. And I think you brought that up. I think you meant that. But the 66 games, I thought that was too many. I thought you saw a lot of injuries because guys were not in shape when they came back because no one thought they were going to play for the entire season. So perhaps I have a different opinion about these lockouts. It just boggles my mind why anyone would want to lock their players out. And more importantly, it boggles my mind why any player would want to be locked out. How much money they're making. They're not getting their same reimbursement from the union. And more importantly, with these lockouts, is that these guys get fat and lazy and then they wind up getting hurt. And it's kind of sad. I'd rather watch them play basketball than watch them in suit and ties pointing fingers at each other and saying, ooh, ooh, ooh. So I guess I'm a little different. I guess I'm just old school, Zeb.
Well, yeah, you see it a lot. You see it from the fans' perspective, and I respect that. You know,
and I see it from a business side too. And we talked about that in the first segment, where I think the salary cap is ridiculous because it doesn't ensure fair play. Because small market teams wind up still losing their players. Guys are leaving and taking less money. So I mean, how did the salary cap help at all? It didn't. It's actually allowed super teams like Miami to be built. And fortunately, they fixed that with the new CBA, so it'll be a little tougher. Draft picks are more important. But anyhow, those are good points, though. I respect your opinion, dude, and I respect Stampler's opinion before. I just have differences of opinion, and that's what makes this show great. The other thing that really irked me about David Stern, besides the Seattle thing that you don't want to talk about, that's fair enough, the Chris Paul trade. Now, when the NBA, I said this out loud on my show, is when the NBA, or actually I said it on my blog, when the NBA became a situation where it became an owner of a team, that's when you're going to have problems. And you can ask the Laker people, they say that David Stern stepped in, stopped that, and it killed the Lakers. What did you think about that Chris Paul trade veto?
Well, you know, you've always got to make hard decisions as a commissioner. And it's not necessarily one that, you know, I agree with, because, I mean, I think that if I was the commissioner and Chris Paul was going to my biggest market team, I would be happy. But you've always got to play a delicate balancing game. And I think that what David Stern might have been thinking at the time is just maybe that he needs to keep small market teams strong. He needs to get away from this idea that small market teams are going to lose their big stars, because, I mean, the Hornets are a franchise that were really on the up and up in the early 90s, and they were going to they had a chance of being a championship contender, but George Shinn was too much of a cheapskate to pay them. So they, you know, all the players ended up leaving. And then New Orleans Hornets, same thing. George Shinn was still the owner. Then he left the team. Then the team went into, you know, default with the NBA, and Chris Paul is about to leave. And, you know, the Hornets never saw any extended success due to that. So it's, you know, I think that at the time he was maybe hoping that the Hornets can maybe put it together and be a win team. But, you know, it's really hard to say, like, what his mindset was. He might, you know, just not want to encourage conspiracy theories too much because he doesn't want to look like he's favoring the Lakers, and the veto is bad. You know, it's really hard to judge, like, what exactly he was doing. But, I mean, I think it was probably a bad move. That's what I'd say. It was probably a bad move. But I could kind of see why he made it.
Okay. You know what? I can sort of see why he did it too, and that's because he's Dictator Stern, and that's what he did his entire 30-year career.
So you don't think there was any like any logic behind it? I'm curious. What do you think the logic behind it was?
The logic behind it was to screw the Lakers.
Really? You think he wants to screw the Lakers? Because they make him millions of dollars. Why would he want to screw his best franchise?
They make him millions of dollars whether they win or not. That's the whole thing. They're still making him money. But here's the thing. How do you veto a trade that sends Chris Paul, who wasn't going to stay anyway and who later he allowed to be traded to the Clippers for a hell of a lot less? And he, what did they receive? They would have received Kevin Martin, Luis Scola, Goran Dragic, and Lamar Odom. I think that would have been the pretty good nucleus there. And, of course, they had that first-round pick, and that first-round pick would have been Anthony Davis, and that would have been a heck of a basketball team there. But that didn't work out.
Well, I mean, I just don't think that that – I mean, I don't think that that would necessarily have been a good deal at the time. Dragic broke out this year, but before that, he was just kind of considered an average kind of borderline starter guard. Kevin Martin has always had huge injury issues. Luis Scola is really old. Lamar Odom's basically out of the league. And if you consider that today, you know, Anthony Davis had injury issues. If you kind of made that a team today, I mean, they would be kind of mismatched. They'd be kind of like the Timberwolves. You wouldn't really know what direction they were going in, whereas the other trade kind of made them get more of a solid rebuilding package, and now they're a younger team. So you could definitely look at it from that perspective, which I wasn't looking at it when I was talking earlier. But, I mean, you know, it's all about opinion, and I think there are some people who perfectly say it's a good trade that it could happen, and if I were David Stern, I would have let the trade pass through. But, you know, I mean, I think that you made a really good point in that the Lakers always make money, no matter what. They're always going to make money. So, you know, even if they're losing, you know, he doesn't need to have them be good, so he doesn't need to approve that trade.
Yeah, you know something? I live in Europe, as you know, and I have for the past 12 years, and I don't see a lot of NBA jerseys, but when I do, they're Lakers, and they're Kobe. So, I mean, it is what it is. They make money over there, dude. And, you know, and half these people don't even know who Kobe Bryant is. They just like the shirt. But that still puts money in the NBA coffer. But that was a difficult thing for me to swallow because, you know, unless he had a crystal ball, that was a good trade. It was very fair. It benefited everyone because Houston would have wound up with Paul Gasol, and that would have been a good move for him and them. And you know what? No one could tell that Goran Dragic was not going to be busting out for another 2 years. No one knew that Lamar Odom was headed into the crack factory. I mean, Scola is still a decent player. Kevin Martin would have blown up sooner, maybe. You know, had he been given a chance to start. But interesting stuff. Now, another thing that was really troubling to me on a lot of levels was the Tim Donaghy officiating scandal.
Yeah.
That was troubling because Dick Bavetta got caught up in that, and Dick Bavetta is a lot of things, but a game fixer, he is not. That's it. I will stand behind him 100% on that. I might disagree with him for not giving me a Gatorade hat because I cracked on him, but that's neither here nor there at a summer camp. But that's neither here nor there. But needless to say, I was at a camp with him and I refereed with him and I was cracking on him. I said, I'm going to be Nick Bavetta tonight. And I say, by the way, before I go to this next tennis camp I got to do, dude, I need two of those white Gatorade NBA hats. And he said, F you, you only get one. For calling me Nick Bavetta. But he was a beautiful human being and still is. But Tim Donaghy, rogue official. And the thing is, and this is the complaint, is that with security the way it is, and NFL security is huge, NBA security is huge, because at that camp, it was actually Anthony Mason's camp up at Kenny Fielder's summer camp grounds, where he has a sports camp. Anyhow, NBA security knew who was there. They knew everything about what was going on. NFL security did too, because they were there the week before with Kenny's son Jay. So, I mean, they know what's going on. Why aren't they watching these referees? That's the one thing that I always wondered about.
Well, you know, it's an interesting question, because I think that one thing people don't understand about refereeing just in general is that referees is that the rule book is really open to interpretation. I mean, there aren't a lot of hard and fast rules. exactly defining what is what. And they're obviously working on that because they adjust the rules every year. But I think that a whole lot is left up to judgment. And when you're seeing the action in real time and you're sitting there and you have to concentrate on it, you've got to make split-second decisions, it's extremely hard. I mean, these guys work really hard at what they do. They make, you know, they work hard to make great calls. And it's, you know, I think that there's a lot of blame that's put in the wrong direction just because people, you know, want to blame it. And that's natural and that's okay, but doesn't necessarily mean I have to like it. And I think that the whole Tim Donaghy thing was the one thing that David Stur couldn't really put down any rumors towards, but he, you know, it kind of went away. I mean, it bothers you, but I don't think that there's a lot of people who kind of have it in their mental conscience. You don't hear it being talked about on ESPN. You don't hear, I mean, you hear about steroids in baseball all the time. Do you hear about gambling in NBA all the time? Once Tim Donaghy went away, he was gone. Yet there might still be other referees out there gambling. You never know. So it's, you know, obviously not Dick Pivetta, because I agree with you, great human being, love watching on TV. But it's, you know, it's hard to, it's really hard to say whether refereeing, whether the referees are gambling on the game, why they don't have more security on it. And, you know, it might just be one of those things where the NBA's right hand doesn't know what its left hand is doing. But it's a really weird situation. I wish they would have a stricter set of rules for their refs.
Well, yeah, when he's enforcing dress codes on players and they are watching these players and who they associate with, and there's clauses in these kids' contracts where, you know, you have to be careful who you associate with and who you bring around the club. And that's perfectly fair, because these team owners have to protect their investment, obviously. But how much more important would it be to protect the integrity of the league, to make sure that these referees aren't doing things? As a former referee, not in the NBA, but it turned my stomach, because you know what? You get accused all the time. Oh, you don't like our team and you blow calls. Let me tell you something. The games happen so quickly, even at a high school level, that if you have to, you'd have to actually go out there and intentionally look for something to screw somebody. You can't watch the clock and the play at the same time and say, ooh, I better call one now. It doesn't work that way. Things happen so quickly, even if you wanted to, 99 times out of 100, you couldn't. And this guy was out there bad, intentionally damaging the game, and he went to prison, and God bless you. You're right, people don't talk about it that much, but they still bring it up when they talk about his legacy. And it's important that we understand that. That his legacy, a lot of it has to do with some of these issues. And some of these issues, Zev, that he just failed to address. Now, we've got time for a real quick one. 1 minute and a half. The 1985 NBA Draft Lottery. The New York Knicks got themselves the first pick, and it was kind of nefarious. What did you think about that real quick? Because I know that you're a Golden State Warrior fan, and you guys got scroogied.
Yeah, well, I was born in 1991, but when I went back and watched that video on YouTube in 1984, I was really pissed, because the Golden State Warriors had the worst record that year. They've been a historically terrible franchise since the 1970s. They were on track to get Patrick Ewing. Patrick Ewing said in an interview, "I'm excited about going to the Golden State Warriors. We might have had a good team in the 90s. He might have been, you know, we might have been making the playoffs. We might have been challenging Jordan, but there was that frozen envelope. He put it in there. Everybody got a 50-50 chance out of the seven worst teams in the NBA. One of the worst debacles in the history of the NBA right there. That was terrible. I don't, you know, I mean, he did a good job of getting a big star to a big market like the Knicks, because people need to watch the Knicks. But at the same time, I hate it. You know, I hate that that happened. And I'm glad that they instituted at least a little bit more reasonable of a lottery system after that, because, you know, there's no way it should have come to that. I wasn't alive at the time, so I don't know how it happened exactly, but I think that that was just a terrible mistake.
Yep, it sure was. And God bless the New York Knicks for getting it. Anyhow, Zeb, great stuff tonight. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, that was Zeb Benbrook. You can find him at welcometoloudcity.com. And that's going to wrap it up for today's show. Tomorrow, we will be talking Major League Baseball. Until then, you all be good.
Ladies and gentlemen, my mother thanks you. My father thanks you. My sister thanks you, and I thank you.
You've just listened to a pre-recorded edition of The Phil Nason Show. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at FlashTennis31. Thanks for listening, and see you tomorrow.